Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking with you about microplastics in the ecosystem of the Great Lakes. And we have a couple of guests who are doing some really cool research looking at microplastics. Heron Wei is an assistant professor in the Environmental Chemistry and Technology program of the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Heron, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
And with us as well, Jenny Carlton. Jenny is the Education Outreach Specialist for the Wisconsin Sea Grant. And Jenny, it's great to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. What do you think about microplastics? It's a big issue, as we're going to be finding out here as we talk with our guests. And just to start with, we got nanoplastics, Horan. We've got microplastics. What basically are they? Just to get everybody on the same page here.
So the microplastic is defined as a plastic particle or fiber or whatever stuff, they have a dimension smaller than 5 millimeter. So it's
pretty small.
Pretty small. And for nanoplastic is a particle smaller than 1 micrometer.
And they contaminate and wind up in, I think I saw something like in the U.S., about 94% of tap water. Is that absolutely true, that samples with microplastics?
Yeah, I believe you, Larry, but I haven't seen the paper you read, and I didn't do a lot of experiments now for drinking water microplastic analysis, but I believe they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. Jenny, why? And we need to be concerned about these in the Great Lakes.
Yes, I think one of the reasons we want to be concerned about them in the Great Lakes is that, of course, Lake Superior and Lake Michigan are at the headwaters of our other Great Lakes. And so what happens here in Wisconsin affects all of the sort of downstream lakes, the other Great Lakes as well. And also here in Wisconsin, even if you're not in those two watersheds, you're probably in the Mississippi watershed, which of course flows to the Gulf of Mexico. So Wisconsin has a big influence on what happens to water quality in many other locations besides just Wisconsin.
And the Great Lakes provide drinking water for, 40 million people, something like that?
Yeah, that's about right.
Mm-hmm. And the researchers have found microplastics in blood, even human blood, even breast milk, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there's a lot of research going on as to where they're occurring and how frequently they're occurring. And pretty much scientists are saying that where they look, they typically find them. The quantities, of course, differ from one location to the next.
And what do we know about the effects on human health? Do we know anything yet? Has there been any research? Or I'm sure there's ongoing research, but have we got anything conclusive on it?
I think the microplastic can cause inflammation, and sometimes it can get into the cells, tissues. But these are all the experimental results from animal-related models. But for human being, you know, it's really hard to conclude any toxicity. I mean, they definitely there are the power of evidence showing the toxicity of microplastics, but it's hard to say anything conclusive for human toxicity.
Yeah.
But yeah, we need more research to investigate that.
Well, if it's turning up in breast milk, I got to believe there's not a parent in the world who wants to have their child drinking their mother's milk that has microplastics in it, or anything else for that matter, other than the real thing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, Horan, your team of researchers has developed ways to detect these very small microplastic particles. How do you do it?
So for microplastic in the Great Lakes, their concentration is about like a, there are two units. So one is about particle number per square kilometer of surface water. So it's super low, it's 5,000 to 10,000. So we have to filter the water out, filter the microplastic out from the water. And once the microplastic are on the membrane, we just do a Raman spectroscopy imaging of the membrane surface. So it's like we shoot a laser onto the membrane at one location, by one spot by spot. We got a map, and we track specific fingerprint of the microplastic. Then we know they are there, and what are they, and what the morphology are they. So our work in this project is to, for my part, is to develop a new type of membrane that can accelerate the scanning rate, because you don't want to spend hours to analyze one sample. It's way too slow and expensive.
Yeah.
So our technology can reduce the scanning time by 100 times or more. So it's like a new type of imaging substrate by taking advantage of unique optical properties of nanostructures. So
that's a pretty cool thing. And in terms of the amount in the Great Lakes, I heard some ungodly amounts. It seemed like to me 22 million tons or something like that.
So annually there are about like 10,000 tons of plastic got transported into the Great Lakes. So this is estimated amount, like 10,000 tons per year. And so a lot of them can be degraded by either sunlight, if it floats on the top, or by the mechanical force, by the waves. Sometimes you have some microbial action. And overall, the big plastic got be decomposed into small ones, smaller and smaller particles. So so actually when I want to start to write a proposal about it, that's because I read an article saying so the plastic got transported to the marine, the ocean, and the plastic we can eventually recover, they have a huge gap. So it seems like a lot of plastic disappear. So maybe one hypothesis is they just degrade it into a tiny little particle that people can not see, and it's hard to measure. So, and then I searched literature at that time. I saw, only a little data exists for this tiny little particle in the Great Lake, which is important water, like drinking water supply and for recreational activities. And so I think that motivated me to develop a method to measure them.
So what type of plastics pollution produces microplastic? What happens there, Jenny?
Yeah, so virtually any type of plastic. You may have heard of Millie Zantel before. PBS Education has a biography about her. She's a Wisconsin resident who created the resin coating system that we use to identify plastics. And generally, we use seven different types. And all of those types of plastics can degrade into smaller pieces of microplastics. As you mentioned earlier, when we do our laundry, if it's synthetic fibers, polyester, rayon, and all different types of things, those can come off in the laundry and go into the wastewater stream, and it's very difficult to remove those particles from our wastewater stream once they're in it. So there's lots of different sources of these microplastics. There's been studies done about tires and on the roads. Here in Wisconsin, of course, we have road salts that can potentially degrade those tires as well. And again, they're looking at a variety of different things, many researchers involved in this from many different angles. We're still learning so much, and there's still so much we don't know. And that's one of the reasons that these are often referred to as emerging contaminants, because we just don't know as much as we'd really like to know about them.
Yeah. And the Wisconsin Sea Grant directed federal funding to Horan's research. And this year, more grant funding from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was awarded to him with a related project that you're working on.
Yes. So the two projects overlap to some degree, because the project I'm working on is designed to work with students at Mount Mary University who are studying in the fashion department. Fashion is, according to the United Nations Environmental Program, the fifth leading, they're responsible for about a fifth of the plastic pollution that's entering the global production every year, and that's a significant amount. And of course, the fashion students aren't actually producing those textiles, but they have influence over what types of textiles are being produced and the products that they're creating and moving forward in their career. So that was one of the reasons we chose this particular group of individuals to work with.
Sure. And this federal research, these federal research dollars, I should say, got to be important for this work.
Yeah, so this money comes from the bipartisan infrastructure legislation that was recently passed. And so it is a significant amount that wasn't available previously. And there are a variety of projects funded all across the U.S., not just here in Wisconsin. And again, they're looking at a variety of different topics depending on the state. Information about these grants are available on the NOAA website if listeners are interested in learning about some of the others. But here in Wisconsin, we received funding for these two projects, and we're very thankful.
Yeah.
We did quite well in this nationwide competition.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super important for my research too. So it, so we need a lot of like investment to build a modular or prototype analytical platform that include the sample pretreatment, like including digestion, filtration, separation, and then we developed a tool to accelerate the scanning of microplastic on a membrane surface. And we need a modular sampler that we can put on the boat, because, you know, each time we need to filter at least tens of liters of water. So it is really time consuming to transport this amount of water to the lab for the analysis. And in the third year of this project, we will go on the boat of the EPA. It's the biggest vessel they have for the sampling on the Great Lakes. So we put the sampler there, and we just do the sampling on the boat. Yes.
Right on the boat. Horan Wei is an assistant professor in the Environmental Chemistry and Technology program in the UW College, Madison College of Engineering. Jenny Carlton is the education outreach specialist for the Wisconsin Sea Grant, as we talk with them about microplastics and the work that they are doing. Questions for you, for them, I hope you'll join in. I see we have a couple of email questions. If you have one, you could email us to talk@wpr.org. If you'd like to join in by phone, that would be great too. It's 800 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at microplastics on the program today and some really cool research on what's going on with microplastics in the Great Lakes. Horan Wei is an assistant professor in the College of Engineering, Ginny Carlton with the UW Sea Grant Program. Great to have them with us. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Mike in Madison emailed to ask if household cleaners like Bon Ami or Bartender's Friend, do those kind of products contain microplastics? And then sort of, are there resources listing what products include microplastics?
So I don't know the particulars of those specific products.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, small microplastics have been eliminated from consumer products in the U.S. and within Canada based on past legislation. The cleaning products, I'm not sure whether they fall within this legislation, but products of like facial wash and toothpaste that at one time contained small microbeads, they were called. Mm. They were basically scrubs to get your skin really clean. They were intentionally put into these products. A number of years ago, they were banned by legislation.
Like the old lava soap, that would probably be an example.
Perhaps. Again, I'm not familiar to say specifically.
I remember it from my younger days. It was kind of grainy, and but it did a good job, but it was a little bit grainy for sure.
Yeah, other things that might be used could be little pieces of sand, you know, natural type products to create that abrasion type effect.
Marilyn emailed to ask whether the coating on dishwasher and laundry detergent tabs contribute to microplastic pollution, or is that a harmless coating?
I have no idea what they're made out of, so I couldn't say one way or the other. Yeah. I hadn't never thought about it before.
Yeah, I need to look it up. Yeah, I don't know the chemical composition of that coating. It could be like a biodegradable materials. It could be just polymer, like synthetic polymer that we consider as macroplastic source, but.
Yeah, we're not sure on that. Let's go to Steve in Cumberland. Steve, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. I'm curious about just a summary of what your guests might say the general health hazards are from microplastics in the water. I appreciate your call. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Steve, for calling. We did touched on it a little bit. Maybe, Jenny, we start with you, and Horan, you can chime in, too.
Yeah, so I am not an epidemiologist or do no medical work at all, so I'm not really able to speak to the health consequences of these. And again, I think the main emphasis right now is that we don't really know, right? We haven't really done these studies on human subjects for a variety of ethical reasons. There are animal-based studies that we're looking into and how that's affecting those other species, but we don't really understand the health effects. We also don't understand how much we may be ingesting or inhaling or how these plastics may be entering our bodies in other ways as well. So many unknown things still.
Do they hang in the air? I mean, is this something I could get into your lungs, Horan?
Yes. We got detectable macroplastics in the air samples too. And also I want to follow up with this question. So for microplastics, I mean when their size is really small, they can get into the tissues.
Yeah.
That is known. But for the human toxicity is unknown, because you cannot do any test for that aspect. And also another toxicity of macroplastic is they can absorb toxic chemicals. So they are in the water. They are there for hundreds of years, and then they have a high surface area, and then some toxic chemical like a perfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, or like a mercury or a PCB, or something like that, mm-hmm. can get onto the surface. And the fish will take this. I mean, so first of all, this there is an unknown which fish will accumulate this macroplastic, right? In this project, we're starting from the benthic, living creatures. So water flea, like a plankton, and also fathead minnows.
Flathead minnows.
Yeah, this different like trophic levels. We're trying to figure out if the microplastic and nanoplastic can get into the plankton, and then if it can biomagnify in the fish, just like a mercury and PCB. So that's what we're trying to find out. And if it is, so we're going to try and find out what type of microplastic can be easier to be bioaccumulated and biomagnified, and what size, how what is the influence of the size of the plastic particles on this bioaccumulation.
Earlier you had asked about the different types of plastic, and because there's different types, they do behave differently. So some of them will float, some of them will sink, and some of them will stay within the middle of the water column. And so it's very difficult to generalize what will happen because it's very dependent on where they're positioned within the water and how long they hold that position, and the organisms that they come in contact with while they're there. So it's a very complex system to try to study and understand.
Yeah, for sure. Penny in Winona County, Minnesota, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Penny.
Yeah, hi, good morning, Larry. So what I wanted to mention, I had recently gotten a new dishwasher. It gave me like a coupon for those pods. So for the first time, I started using them. And then I started thinking about it, and I did look it up. And it said those laundry and dishwasher pods do contain plastic. I thought they were just some sort of biodegradable, you know, dissolvable thing. So I have now stopped using all those plastics and have switched to just a powdered or a liquid detergent that you just add, you know, without any coating.
Whoa, good for you, Penny. That's and if it's plastic, if there's any plastic, it's going to be, it can turn into these microplastics.
Yes.
So yes. Anything with plastic, that's what's going to happen. Penny, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Appreciate it. Bob in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Bob.
Hello. About 10 years ago, I did a tour of the Chicago Water Works, and they said the water came down from actually Lake Superior and was very refreshing. But they also say that it contained microplastics. So my question is, how did it really come from Lake Superior, and how did the microplastics get into it?
Yeah.
So I can listen on the air.
All right.
So the sources of microplastics to the Great Lakes include the wastewater treatment plant effluent. Mm. So we got a lot of daily life waste flow into the wastewater treatment plant, like in the washing or like washer. So you have the textile breakdown into the little plastics. Like you see in your a dryer, right? As
sure.
You always got a pile of entangled fibers, but they can be break into very tiny little pieces and flow into the macro the wastewater treatment plant, and that's a major source. And there's industrial wastewater discharge too, and stormwater runoff. So you got water for example, you got a high in the highway, there's a lot of like particles from tire, right?
Yeah.
And after heavy rain, all this got to be washed off and into the streams, like tributary, and then flow into the Great Lakes. And also, there are some like deposition from air, but there's a minor contribution. So for Lake Superior, I think it's the cleanest lake because it's compared to Lake Ontario or Lake Erie, it's not like they're not like urbanized like area, and it's a bigger than smaller lakes. So the current data shows the macroplastic with a size higher than 100 micrometer is the slowest for Lake Superior.
Yeah, so there was a 2016 study by a person named Heartline, and they were looking at the ability of these wastewater treatment plants to remove these particles. And due to their small size, it's very, very difficult. And again, some float, some settle, some stay in the middle. And their estimates of the researchers were that the water treatment plants released up to 40% of the microfibers they received. So, in other words, once it's in there, it's extremely difficult and not cost-effective to take it back out. So prevention is, you know, way easier than trying to deal with the problem afterward.
Excuse me, I had a bit of a cough there, but that was my question. You know, how the heck would you filter that? I mean, these are so small. To provide a filter, it was almost you'd have to block the whole thing, Horan.
So that's what we. There's one task we're gonna do in this project to filter out the very, very tiny, like a tiniest portion of microplastic. So far, for the USGS and the US EPA, they have a method that using they call Manta net. So this a net looks very similar to Manta. They put it in the end of the boat and then drive the boat across the lake, and then they can capture plastic particles larger than 100 micrometer, but they cannot detect smaller particles.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why we want to develop like a on boat what we call fractionated membrane filtration module. So we call it fractionated because they have a multiple stages membranes with different sizes, but they're all smaller than 100 micro. And then we can separate microplastic with different sizes by using this module. And then we do an optical scan across all the membrane surfaces. And so we can know small particles. Yeah.
You know, Michael emailed us, and this is kind of invoking the precautionary principle. Don't we know enough to at least ban plastics and used in single-use products like bags and utensils and straws, plastic straws that are put to trivial uses? Don't we know enough about that?
Yeah, so I would say the politics of any product and the use of that product is government policy, and the government policy is up to the people that are electing those people who are creating those policies. So yes, there's information about by researchers, you know, the impacts of these things, just as there's research about the impacts of many other products, cigarettes, you know, all different kinds of things, alcohol, and, you know, the politics of what we allow our citizens to use and what we don't allow them to use is just that, politics. So,
and just to that point, someone sent a note that there's a new bill proposed. This came from ABC7 in New York. There's a new bill proposed in New York City that would ban detergent pods due to microplastics and would make selling or distributing detergent pods or laundry sheets with those with polyvinyl alcohol illegal. So that kind of goes to what you were talking about, Jenny.
Yes. There's also been legislation introduced in California related to requiring filters on washing machines, on new washing machines. So there's a variety of ideas that people are putting forward that may or may not help to address this concern. And I think one of the things that we try to strive to do is inform people, you know, about the research and the educational efforts that are going on so that people can either make personal choices in their own homes and their own businesses and their own recreational pursuits. You know, that's another big source sometimes of things going overboard on your recreational vehicle, your boats. We don't necessarily think about that so much, but there's so many different sources, and every one of us probably contributes every day without even realizing it. So that's, you know, what we're hoping to try to educate people about, the different ways that they have an influence on this.
Doug sent an email from Rice Lake, and I had mentioned Lava Soap earlier and how it felt back in the day when I was a young guy. But Doug from Rice Lake called to say he understands that Lava Soap does not contain microplastics, so I don't want to... I don't want to have everybody who uses Lava Soap stop using it. Man, Eric in Luxembourg, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I heard you talking about not being able to filter it out of the wastewater treatment plants, and also not really being able to filter it out in your water supply facilities. Will a reverse osmosis filter in your home water for your drinking water, will it take all the microplastics out?
Yes, definitely. That reverse osmosis can take off everything, I think, including the salts, right? So the microplastic, nanoplastic can be filtered by the reverse osmosis or even the nanofiltration membranes. But for the wastewater treatment plants, so a lot of them do not have like the delicate filters that have the pore size similar to RO or nanofiltration or ultrafiltration. Sometimes it's like just like a ordinary like a sand filter or carbon block. I think that's already the most advanced, but a lot of do not have that, right? There's just sedimentation, and then the waters flow out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Eric, thank you very much for calling. Hey, you're safe. If you got it, if you got the reverse osmosis in your home, that's working for you. Karen in La Crosse emailed to say they just looked at the label on their bottle of Barkeeper's Friend. The label notes oxalic acid as an ingredient, and other ingredients aren't listed. They also have an old container of a cosmetic product called Pernox. It's a face wash for oily skin, and this product lists the ingredient abradant polyethylene granules. It's apparent that consumers need to know more about the components in consumer products and their impact on our shelves and our environment.
Yeah, so polyethylene is a plastic, and that item, businesses can no longer create an item like that one she currently has. So it is an older product, yes.
Throw that one out, Karen.
You know, but the reality is everywhere is somewhere. Nowhere is away. So it goes to the landfill, the container degrades, and... You know, it will always be with us in one form or another.
I mean, how long will these things last? I mean, I suppose it depends on the plastic.
Hundreds of thousands of years. So it's very long. They can break down into like smaller particles by the mechanical force of the sunlight and radiation because of the defects. But as to make it fully converted into like monomer, their precursors, will take a long time, like because in the nature we do not have the microbes that can like decompose this like man-made, like recently made stuff. So you consider the short history of plastic like about 100 years compared to other stuff, right? So it's a very short time. The nature need to take at least thousands of years to develop, to evolve the microbes that can decompose them.
Yeah, they can. Yeah. You know, I know there's some greenhouse gases that microbes can get at and eat up, but they've had a long time to evolve to deal with it. So there you go. David in Verona, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry. Your guests are doing a great job of explaining how microplastics are accumulating in the Great Lakes and in the environment, but they seem to be backing away from talking about any health or environmental consequences of them because there isn't enough information. But the whole point of having this show is to that we think that this is a bad thing. I mean, nobody is really advocating that we should have more microplastics in our lakes and environment. Why don't they say that this is something that should be stopped?
Yeah, all right. Well, Oren, what do you think?
So I didn't talk about more about the toxicity or the environmental hazards of this microplastic because I'm not a toxicologist. I'm an environmental analytical chemist. And actually, in our team, we have Gavin Dannert from Wisconsin Seagram. He is a toxicologist. See, I think if he is on the show, he will have tons of things to say about toxicity. So actually, there are tons of literature reporting the toxicity of microplastics. Not only the direct health, like toxicity to some living creatures in that water, but also the ecosystem risk, right? So when you have, so think about a plastic. If you have 1 millimeter plastic particle, it can degrade into 1 million 10 micrometer particle, right? So when this particle like just accumulate in the water, so it could shift some like maybe the living creature population or community, not only in the water column but also in the sediment, because there are a lot of plastic are like heavier than water and just go to the sediment like the PVC, like right.
That makes and Jenny, I mean that's kind of, you know, to David's point, that's kind of we have a ton of research out there, and the reason you're doing the work that you're doing is because you think you know that there are human health and environmental concerns that need to be addressed, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I would agree that we're aware that there's concerns here, right? And that's one of the reasons we're trying to make people more aware of some of these issues. I would say that part of the my hesitation is also the philosophy of the organization that I work for. Mm-hmm. So Wisconsin Sea Grant is based in research, education, and outreach, not advocacy. And so there are other organizations whose mission is to put forward a specific solution and advocate for that solution. That's not Wisconsin Sea Grant's role. Our role is to provide information to others so that they can make decisions for themselves and their families and those they come into contact with. And we don't serve an advocacy role.
You do serve an education role, though, and I was thinking about you mentioned earlier with fashion, and your grant funding, as a matter of fact, will help teach fashion school faculty and students how to reduce polyester clothing fiber waste.
Yes. So it's sort of a fine line here, you know, and I acknowledge that of... You know, is education advocacy? In some ways, it is, right? The topics you choose to talk about, you're choosing them for a particular reason. But I guess the politics of it, we try to stay saying you should do this or you shouldn't do this. We're trying to inform people of the different impacts and the different things to think about as opposed to telling them what to do or what not to do.
Yeah, okay. Paul in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Larry. Great program today. And I just wanted to follow up on a couple of the callers' observations about, you know, why don't we do something about this, or don't we know enough about this to do something about this? And about 15, 20 years ago, I began a project in Madison which had to do with recycling consumer waste generated at events, which was, you know, plastic bottles and aluminum cans and that sort of thing. And the biggest question that people that volunteered to help on this was, why can't we recycle this kind of plastic bottle or this kind of plastic cup? And I think that was pretty well answered earlier because of the chemical makeup of these things. They don't always break down the way that they got built up, so to speak. But the point is that all of these things, whether the university researchers are doing advocacy in the political ring or not, they are all political activities based on laws. And these laws will not get changed unless individuals take up this as their life's quest. I mean, I've made recycling my life's quest, and, you know, I'm as guilty of mishandling consumer waste as many other people, but it requires a huge commitment by every individual to actually advocate to their representatives and tell them that they want laws that will change this. There are many organizations representing big industries that are lobbying the legislature and the federal government all the time to keep their business models in place so that they continue making more plastic. And yet, on the consumer side, there is nowhere near as much muscle. And
I think you're right. You may well be right, Paul. And I want to get a comment from our two guests with just a quick reminder. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about earning a degree as an older adult, and then we discuss what it takes to be a substitute teacher. So that'll be interesting tomorrow. Right now, we're talking about an interesting topic as well, and that's microplastics and the research and work that's going on at Horan Way from the Environmental Chemistry and Tech Program at the UW-Madison College of Engineering, and Ginny Carlton from the Sea Grant program at UW are doing. And Paul had made a nice comment or a comment. I wondered if you could react to his comment. Ginny, start with you.
So he was talking about recycling campaigns, and one of our educational kits expands what is commonly known as the 3 R's, reduce, reuse, and recycle, to 8 R's. And I just want to show you, obviously your listeners can't see this, but we have made on plastic a variety of display cards that says rethink your choices, refuse single-use items, reduce consumption, reuse everything, refurbish old stuff, repair before you replace, repurpose and be creative, and recycle as your last option. So often we think about, oh, I'm just going to recycle it, but perhaps you might not purchase it in the first place if you're rethinking your options. So a variety of different things that we're sharing with our school children, with our educators, with non-formal educators, and anyone we come across.
Yeah, for sure. And Horan, a comment?
Yeah. My comment is maybe rudimentary. It's just the recycle. It's recycling is a great thing to reduce microplastic in the environment. Yeah. And
anything you can do to get rid of it in a proper way.
If the microplastic already in the water or sediment, it's really hard. I mean, if it's in the water column, probably you can build a robot to filter out all this plastic, but for the smaller ones, it's going to take energy, right? So take energy to filter the water, because you need to have a small size, pore size of membranes.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about climate change, and I know that the expert, Rob Jackson, has pounded away in his book at saying it's a whole lot cheaper to stop it before it begins than to, like, pull the carbon out of the air. And it's the same with microplastics or probably anything else. It's always cheaper to stop it before it gets there.
Yeah, definitely from the perspective of thermodynamics, right?
Kurt in Poinette has a question. Hi, Kurt.
Hello, Larry and guests. My question is, I live in the rural county, Columbia County here, and I have a well water. Is my well water safe from these plastics?
Private wells. That's a good question, Kurt.
I think it is safer than public water, right? So it's because the groundwater usually, it's hard for the microplastic to penetrate. Penetrate the sand, soil, and eventually reach the groundwater aquifer and get into the well. Compared to surface water, it's cleaner from microplastics.
Is there any kind of a test that Kurt or anybody else could, you know, say, I want to check and see if I've got in my private well water or in my public water?
I mean, test for microplastics.
Yeah, if I could, you know, somebody like Kurt, could he, you know, fill a glass of water and then, you know, put something in it that's going to tell him?
We can do that, but it's expensive. For
okay.
Now. Yeah. It's particle analysis. It's not like the chemical, right?
Yeah.
The chemical, like, we can do it, although it's also expensive. but for particle is harder. Yeah.
Mike from Madison emailed to remind that reverse osmosis water system use store filtered water in a pressurized tank that has a plastic and or rubberized liner. And this may introduce plastics back into the drinking water.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, there's really no getting away from plastics in our livelihood. And, you know, today we've been suggesting that they're bad, but they're not all bad. We rely on them for so many things. You know, our healthcare industry is built on plastics. We use them for IVs. We use them for the
needles.
Syringes for our shots. We use them, you know, in little, all different kinds of things. Safety. We used to have glass bottles of shampoo for our bath, and now we have plastic bottles. So there's so many good things that we have going for us because we have these plastics available. They're lighter weight, so our cars are lighter and more fuel efficient. It's just trying to think about how we're using them and why we're using them, and is this the best thing to be doing in this particular instance, or is there something that we might think about as an alternative?
And, you know, and as individuals, as you were talking about earlier, I think I mentioned, you know, you can buy 100% cotton or 100% wool clothing, as an example. You can dispose of plastics properly, as we were talking about. You can perform car maintenance on a regular basis, and that helps with the tires and the other parts of the automobile. Rethink how you do your laundry a little bit. Maybe do it less often, maybe, with larger amounts. A lot of things that we can do, and it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I appreciate it very much, and look forward to another chance to visit with you. Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Larry.
So, Horan Wei from the UW College of Engineering, Jenny Carlton from the Wisconsin Sea Grant Program, talking about their research on microplastics. And coming up, we're going to take a look at reducing greenhouse gases and the whole climate change issue with the author of a new book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.